Blog Talk Radio. We are not alone. And a very, very wonderful good evening to everyone out there tuning into Contact this evening. As always, I am your host, Leslie Mitchell-Clark, and I'm joined also, as always, by our co-host, Mr. Wes Roberts. Good evening, Wes. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, Leslie. I'm great, and I guess we're in the dog days of August, eh?
We are, and you know why they're called the dog days, I suppose.
I don't.
Well, I happen to have that information at hand. It's because Sirius, the dog star, is crossing over us as we speak. So there you go.
All right. I just thought it was hot little pooches running around outside.
Have you ever seen the logo for Sirius Radio?
Yeah.
It's a little doggy.
Yeah, yeah.
There
okay.
You go.
Oh, that's too funny.
So we are in the, or as I would have said in my hometown, New York City, we're in the dog days. D-A-W-G. Not dog, like below the Mason-Dixon line.
But yeah, got that.
Dog, like in Brooklyn. Anyway, we're very, very happy that everyone is tuned in once again this evening. And as always, we are here to explore all things ufology related. We dip into metaphysics, magic, physical events, anything that basically is arcane and a bit to the left, we are into it. So we're very happy that you've joined us this evening. And we have a wonderful guest who is, in fact, based in the Los Angeles area, the Southern California area, and her name is Sahelu, and I believe this is her third visit with us. So we're very fortunate to have been able to arrange for her to visit with us and make time for us in her busy schedule. And how would you describe Sahelu and what she does, Wes, and her interests?
Well, she's a longtime friend. She and I have similar magical interests, and that goes back over 10 years. She's very well versed in dance. Eastern forms of dance, which, you know, perhaps she'll talk about tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So her, if she had a word, it would be movement, because that's what she's all about, is movement.
Wow.
And she's had some, and we don't have to go into this, she's had some interesting physical challenges, but she's overcoming them. She has a dynamic tour that is strength moving forward.
Excellent.
Yeah,
excellent.
So, yeah, so a long time, very close relationship. And I often call her my sister, which I love to do, just like I would call you my sister.
Well, I think that's incredible, and I can't wait to get into our conversation with Sahelu in just a few moments. But before we do, we just have to give a little shout-out to our sponsors. And, of course, without our generous sponsors, there would be no Contact Radio. And first up, we would like to thank Euphoria, the Euphoria organization, and Euphoria Chronicles on Facebook. And the leader of both, Mr. James Borg. And James has been our guest several times. I know that he's going to be away after the first part of September, so I'm hoping that we can get him back on the show in the very near future. So thank you to James Borg, to all of the Euphorians, and the members of Euphoria Chronicles on Facebook. We appreciate your support so much. We would also like to thank Variety Store Productions, and our friend Greg Summer, and he is a marvelous guy who has a full-service studio for all of your needs, pre-production, post-production, on-site shoots, just about anything you can think of. Greg Summer and Variety Store Productions are your go-to source.
And Greg, if you're listening, we hope to be in touch with you soon. It was good to see you at the Alien Cosmic Expo, however briefly.
That's right, and we will be interfacing with Greg Summer on a variety of projects in the future. So, Variety Store Productions. We would also like to thank Conspiracy Culture, and Conspiracy Culture is a bookstore, but much more than a bookstore. It's really a resource center. It is the site of a lecture series, and Conspiracy Culture is run by our dear friend Patrick White and his lovely wife, and do log on to conspiracyculture.com. They are a resource center for all things arcane, whether it's a metaphysical thing that you're interested in, whether it's ufology, whether it is some sort of governmental conspiracy, wide variety of resources there. Conspiracy culture. Okay. And we would also like to thank Enchanted Reveries Jewelry. Beautiful metaphysical jewelry with a touch of magic, all handmade, beautiful ingredients, pewter, natural stones and charms. So do log on to, actually you have to enchantedreveries.etsy.com. That's enchantedreveries.etsy.com, and you can take a look at all those wonderful objects d'art that are being made over there, all handmade.
And I suppose we should give a shout out, and we want to our friend and really the organizer of the Alien Cosmic Expo, Joanne Eady, who we met with very recently. And folks, I hope that you're as excited as we are. We're in the planning stages, the early planning stages of the Cosmic Expo for next year.
That's right. And already we have some amazing people on board, some Canadian firsts, and some ufology firsts. So be sure to log on to aliencosmicexpo.com and to keep apprised of all the wonderful updates. And I believe next year's event is June 24th, 25th, and 26th.
And this will be really interesting, folks. This year was the first one. Of course, the next one's going to be better, more interesting, stronger, more dynamic. We're not going to give away any of the facts yet. That'll all be announced in time. But there's a great group of people who are just coming together to work on this, and you've got to understand that's what it takes.
Yeah, it does. So we're looking forward to that. That is wonderful. And we would also like to thank, as far as our sponsors, the Canadian Hypnosis Convention, which is also coming right up in October. I believe it's October 23rd, 24th, 25th. And Wes and myself will be presenting an in-depth exploration of how hypnosis is used in working with individuals who have had extraterrestrial, ultra-terrestrial encounters or experiences.
Yeah, that's going to be great. And in fact, that was largely responsible for the Alien Cosmic Expo, thanks to Leslie and thanks to her connections. That's how this all rolled out.
So it's all interconnectivity, mm-hmm. Wes, is
yeah.
really, and we the further we get into this subject matter, and any subject matter that involves spirituality, if you wish to call it that, we find incredible interconnectivity, which is a reflection of really quantum mechanics, quantum physics. We are living in a universe, a multidimensional universe of quantum entanglement, I believe.
Yeah, so we'll make the scientist listeners right now very happy by saying that, but we knew this for a long time.
That's right. It's been expressed in every ancient spiritual discipline,
yeah.
From the Native American peoples to the great mystics of the subcontinent, it's ancient China. It's been expressed in Egyptology, in any ancient discipline. The quantum nature of the universe is nothing new to adepts.
No. So for the right brain folks out there, there you have it.
Yes. For the right brain folks who are too strongly situated in your right brain, you can help that. You can fix that simply by listening to Contact every week. It's going to stretch you into your left brain with like a piece of silly putty, whether you believe it or not.
Synchronicity, folks.
Anyway, I think we've been carrying on long enough.
Yes.
Now, did we cover all of our sponsors? I believe that we did. And I would also like to say that this Sunday, it is Sunday now, you're listening to the show, and it is being pre-recorded, so we are not able to take live listener calls this evening, but we will return next weekend live, and we have a wonderful guest. We have our leader of the Wiccan Mystics Coven coming in to speak to us.
Very cool.
Yeah, so we're having a magical couple of weeks.
Yes.
Here. So that will be absolutely fantastic. And there we go. So without further ado, and direct from sunny Southern California, we are welcoming Sahelu. Sahelu, hello. How are you, my dear?
Hello there, Leslie. I'm doing well today. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, it's such a pleasure to hear your voice, and we've been very excited about having you back on the show. And I've been very excited to talk to you because I've recently been reading a very definitive book about Lemuria and the Lemurians, otherwise known as the continent of Mu, which was a Pacific superculture that predates the Atlantean superculture, but in fact they shared a big chunk of the timeline together. And I don't know if you know this, but as a person with Southeast Asian DNA, you are really the holders of Lemurian DNA in our current time.
Wow.
Yeah. It's
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true. And Edgar Cayce said it, you know, almost 100 years ago, but we now have the DNA evidence to show that there is an incredible link between the people of the subcontinent and also the Basque people. And and believe it or not, people of the Pacific Islands, including the Maori of Australia and the Hawaiians, and also certain Native American tribes, namely the Hopi and the Zuni peoples, all share DNA markers which are mysterious and ancient in the extreme. And you folks would have a very, very high incidence of O-type blood, which apparently is one of the big signposts of both Lemurian and Atlantean ancestry. So you're carrying very, very special DNA, Zeheru.
That's amazing. And yes, I will say my blood is O positive.
Oh my goodness. Really? Well,
yes.
There you go. Now, isn't that remarkable? So you're in the top, like, it's the top 2%. Only maybe 1 in 2% of the population has O blood. And I've also noticed, and speaking of dance, there is, in my mind, a big correlation between the traditional dance done in Polynesia and the traditional dance forms of the subcontinent.
Mm. Very interesting. I'm not really familiar with the Polynesian. I will say, you know, when it comes to the, you know, Asia, India more specifically, you know, they have a few different forms of temple dancing that are actually over 3,000 years old. And actually at the moment I'm going to be picking back up my studies on one of them called Bharatanatyam. And it is a fantastically magical, and it's just a four-dimensional communication device, really, is what it is. I mean, it's everything from rhythmical patterns just as they are to expressing poetry and a ritual. You name it can be incorporated. It's a fantastically magical thing.
Indeed. And I think the rhythmical patterns of Polynesian dance and the hip action and the percussive motifs, as well as the gestural language that is incorporated uniquely in dance forms of the subcontinent, I can really see. You have to take your head out of the obvious differences, you know, the grass skirts and the ukuleles and Don Ho. You have to throw that away for a minute and just look at what's actually going on and how it makes you feel. Because I can tell you that the spiritual feeling that is generated, the energy that is generated in its pure sense by Polynesian and maybe Maori dance is even more closer to ground zero. I have gotten that same type of feeling in seeing Indian dance forms with the full, you know, full percussive complement.
I would say I've got experience, you know, doing Middle Eastern dance. I can understand. I've even actually taken a few classes in Polynesian. They're very different as far as their rhythms and their you know, how they use the body, you know, the vertical and horizontal patterns and rhythms. But it's the energies are very, very different. The Polynesian, I wouldn't say it's a little harsher than I would say the Middle Eastern, let's say the Egyptian, the typical classical belly dance, the ballady, which is pretty much the ancient Egyptian style, the classical style. That's very different, you know. And of course, they've you know, nowadays there's all these different fusions and tribal styles, even gothic, industrial, harder edged type things that maybe would fall along more of a, I want to say, a vampiric or darker aspects to them.
Mm.
You know, if you really want to connect to your core being and sort of the, you know, the foundational self, then those are probably something that could be utilized for that reason.
Mm-hmm. It would that be, and I know you're so knowledgeable about this, now, where would something like, I know there's very limited Islamic-approved dance, but if you're talking about something like the dervishes, the whirling dervishes, now that is the dervishes are a sect of Islam, are they not? Like this, are they sort of like the Sufis? They're a metaphysical sect, and the idea of their dance is to achieve, excuse me, a trance-like state?
Correct. Yes, they are Sufi, the whirling dervishes, and predominantly they're mostly male.
Yeah.
If you're getting into the Sufi, I know that there are the Middle Eastern, or the allowable, as you say, Middle Eastern, it is not looked at as something that is a positive thing, especially for women.
Yeah.
They're not allowed to show their bellies. They have to wear a certain mesh, or they have to be fully clothed. That aspect of it, because it's not looked highly at for a woman to do that. Normally, a woman would get together and they would dance and they would have their drummers and it's called a hafla, or a hafla, and they would do that as family and friends and as together as women, just in as like a sisterhood, whether it's family, whether it's close relatives, whether it's close friends, neighbors. They would do something like that.
Well, I say free the hufla.
I know, absolutely.
It's amazing to me, and I'll just say this one sidebar, but it's always astonishing to me that individuals come to believe that they can get closer to creative source, or if you wish, with a restrictive sexist discipline. I don't know. I don't see how anyone could really believe that they are coming closer to the God that created men and women equally as two faces of the same coin, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we pass into different bodies and incarnate into different bodies, how any kind of thinking person can believe that restriction, sexist restriction, any kind of restriction leads you closer to God. And I'm not necessarily pointing a finger at Islam, because there are many beautiful things about that religion. I'm pointing the finger at the right-wing Bible-banging Christians, where
right.
and you know, with who are in the media with these horrible television shows, like, you know, the people with the 19 children who now apparently have a bunch of child molestation stuff going on, the Duggars. I mean, this is
right.
It's astonishing to me that people can be so limited or have such a strange anthropomorphic idea of source that they become so twisted up in repression. You know, I and having been raised a Catholic, I should understand this a little better. Talk about repression at ground zero, but. And an Irish Catholic, nonetheless, where our entire people were suppressed and truncated. But still, I think in our contemporary world, the kinds of art that you are involved in, the fusion art, the bringing the ancient motifs that are tried and true and beautiful into a contemporary society, is one of the most noble things that anybody could possibly do.
Right. Oh, well, thank you. I you know, I feel honored to do that, and it's something that, you know, I've learned that I had access to at a young age. And, you know, as I got older, I just pursued it, and I pursued it, and it became a part of who and what I am as a magical being. And I just, it's just that important that, yes, exactly what you're saying is there's no way that you can grow as an individual personally and outwardly, objectively, you know, and subjectively with bondage of chains and willfully walking into something like that is just, I just do not understand it as well.
No, I do not. But at any rate, as long as we are emanating, you know, love and acceptance will triumph over suppression and restriction. It's the nature of existence, I believe. Now, Sahelu, do you have any, have you ever explored past lives, or do you have any conscious recall of other lifetimes, or do you accept that that is something that we go through?
I do. I definitely am a firm believer of a previous existence outside of this one here, that I'm living in this human flesh and blood body. This human flesh and blood body, ever since I was a child, seemed to, at times to be very awkward and strange and unfamiliar. So yes, I do believe that I have come from somewhere and have come into this body, and I have work that needs to be done while I'm here on this planet and in this body. And whatever it is that I do here, I am making permanent memories and permanent occurrences and permanent happenings, if you will, mm-hmm. and taking those permanent memories with me into the next existence or the next next level of existence.
Mm-hmm. I see. Are there any individuals in your life, be they family or teachers or people that you feel you recognize or know on some soul level that maybe it isn't even logical, maybe it's somebody you've met just in passing, but you have that feeling that you know them?
Yes. My brother here on the show, mm-hmm. Wes, has been one of them. Mm-hmm. When I met him, I'm going to say 12, 13 years ago, when I first met him, I was just absolutely taken aback. And we both just sat there and looked at each other, you know, and I knew who he was. Mm-hmm. I knew him. I didn't know how I knew him or where I've known him, but I've known him.
Yes.
I've known him, and I've known him for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say I've got a few others that I have known in that fashion as well. A handful of people, and it's not an abundance, but it is a handful of people. And if it were not the strength, you know, or the fact and the belief in the, yes, I was somewhere else in some existence and now I'm here, this person also had to have been somewhere else. Otherwise, how could we have not connected? How would we not know each other at this point, you know?
Indeed. Well, one of these days, we will connect when I'm going to be visiting LA again in early October, and we will connect, and I think we should explore perhaps a past life journey.
I agree. I would be honored and just so excited about that.
Okay.
Really.
Well, that's a plan. We will do that.
Okay.
in October for sure. When it cools down enough, I can't take it too hot out there.
Okay. Yes.
You know, my number two son, who is a professional dancer, was just in your neighborhood. He had a series of concerts called Dancer Palooza. And they were performed at the Long Beach Convention Center and a few other things. And I could never get the details from him in order to convey to you and get you there. So I'm a little irked with him right now, but But he'll be in L.A. again, and I promise that won't happen next time. So
wonderful. Great.
And Sahelu may be up this way at some point next year, we are hoping.
Yes.
And then I wanted to just play on something that, Leslie, and you were talking about. What is it that you recognize about a person, whether it's your relationship now with Leslie or your long-term relationship with me? How do you know? How does that strike you?
How do I know?
Mm-hmm. How does it occur to you?
There is a large sense of familiarity. There is a deep soul of just a knowing.
Yeah.
And how do you really define that with a capital K? Let's put it that way, and to say, okay, it's a knowing. This person is extremely familiar to me. I've known this person in the past because I seem to recall, or I get impressions, or I have feelings, whether it's emotional or thoughts that pass through my head, you know, saying, okay, I've had experiences with this individual before, somewhere. It is information that's being crossed between the two of us. And it's an understanding of that familiarity to some degree.
Excellent. It's a soul recognition. It's all
right.
You know, it's all on the soul level. So sometimes these things are hard to express in our conscious terms. But have you ever had the experience where you recognize an individual on that soul level, but you also know that they're toxic? And you don't need to interact with them again. But here they are in your soul group, getting ready to cause trouble, and an alarm goes off, and you're able to avoid yet another negative dance with said individual.
Right. You know, I will say that has definitely occurred. I will say it has been one person in specific, and this person seemed to just be so integrated into what, you know, were my aspects of, you know, magical study and you know, ooh, goodness, this person was the, you know, key to the lock that I needed, the door open to more fully. And yes, there was this deep connection, and it was the connection to the blood that this person was from, you know, from India, from that area, and has family from that area. And this person turned out to be extremely toxic to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I will have to say that, you know, we all make mistakes and we all make errors, and we have to, because we have to learn from them, and it's important that we do. And so, you know, one has to realize when someone like that becomes toxic that it's imperative to eradicate it and destroy it and throw it completely away from you in every aspect.
Indeed. And maybe that is the learning. I think in my life, maybe that is the learning, in recognizing, instead of being in maybe more deeply inveigled, like some kind of drug experience, you know, into a deeper, more negative relationship with said individual, and being able to recognize it and extricate yourself is maybe the lesson. I think, you know, we often talk about this on the show, as far when we're discussing reincarnation, and people talk about their, you know, negative issues with their family and blah, blah, blah. And I think sometimes with certain family members, because I will share with you, the most negative person from my many past lives would be the person who is my biological mother in this life. I don't know how many times we were related, but I can see her as a selfish bitch going back to the dawn of time. But at any rate, sometimes we pick our, I believe that we that there are choices that we make, and sometimes that we select family members or particularly parents, sometimes just for DNA. Now, my own mother is so hung up with her stuff that any psychic abilities that she may have are all twisted up and in recession, I would say. But my grandmother, her mother, was descended from a line of wise women, and my great-great-grandmother was, in fact, for lack of a better term, like a medicine woman in her Swedish tribe. Because the Swedish people far north, you might call them the Laplanders. That's kind of like saying the N-word. They should be called the Sami people. But they're very much like indigenous people, you know, even with the same kind of art and a medicine woman. So that I think that that DNA, I think I needed that DNA. And for the work that I do now, which is relies on a lot of intuition, you know, for lack of a better term. So I think that I may have said, well, okay, you know, I know this individual, you know, is going to be just completely useless as a mother, but that's okay because I'm going to get that familial line of the DNA through the wise women and I will be able to use it and that is more important. So that's kind of how I look at it now, not so much as, oh, woe is me, I was victimized by an innate mother, but, well, that's who she is. The abilities she's carrying in her DNA packet, you know, skipped her, but I have them, and my sister has them. So we both came in, I think, with an understanding that there was a small sacrifice to be made in the parental department for the long range skill set, if you will.
Yes.
That we came in with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I really agree with that. You know, even my own biological parents. You know, I was never raised by my real mother. I was raised by my father and my stepmother.
Oh, very interesting.
Yes, and my stepmother, I never appreciated her when I was a child because she lost my dad's baby when I was 6 years old, and then basically took out all of her anger and resentments against me very physically. You know, she was abusive and so on and so forth. And, you know, I hated her for so long. And, you know, she passed away in 2009. But she taught me so much. You know, she had a master's degree in music, you know, which I believe. And my father is he's a classical jazz guitarist.
Wow.
And he's worked with Gibson. I mean, he's worked with some well-known, you know, jazz, you know, musicians. And, you know, and I think it was the instilling of music theory and rhythm and things like that as a young child and playing the violin at age 5, you know, and was in an orchestra, you know, a few years after that. And the piano and things like this really probably generated a lot of the rhythm and energies needed to incorporate movement and dance into and integrate that into my life as an important tool.
Oh, no doubt. Absolutely no doubt. How interesting. This is another thing we have. My late father was a jazz bassist, a jazz musician, highly recognized, and so that's another thing we share. But I completely agree with you. So in that situation, you took from that, you know, maybe that upsetting familial scenario, there was a reason that you were there and you got what you needed somehow.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Also, I don't know him well, but I met this person that Sahelu's speaking about. And, you know, I just had a vibe, but it's not my place to say that at the time. But I would say Sahelu's probably grown in some phenomenal ways due to that that relationship.
Oh, indeed. It's not the... And my great teacher and mentor, Dr. Georgina Cannon, has often said to me when we're, you know, because she deals pretty much exclusively in past life and interlife regression. That's what she does. But she has said to me before that sometimes an individual simply out of love will assume a negative role for the learning process of the soul in question. In other words, that maybe a parent who is an inept parent, or for lack of a better term, comes in and willfully assumes that negative role simply out of love for the teaching experience for the child, for that soul.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's a very interesting way to look at it. I know it wasn't shortly thereafter that, you know, she lost, you know, the child. It wasn't soon after, I want to say a couple years, and then both my dad and my stepmom became really flaming right-wing fascist Jesus freaks.
Oh my God!
I'm not kidding. I am so not kidding. I mean, it was just like a psalm and a proverb every day, and then I went to the Christian school, and then it was prayer there, and then prayer at nighttime, and then I had to read a chapter with my parents, and then they were involved in the music ministry, and it was services on Sunday morning because they were playing in the music ministry, and then Sunday night, and then Saturday night was. You know, concert. Friday night was movie night. Wednesday night was, it was every single night, every single day. It was just this constant. And I was just, you know, finally I got to the point where I'm going, okay, this is not working at all.
Yeah. Wow. So when I was talking about restrictive religious practices, I mean, you know what I was talking about on a firsthand level. So you know what not to do. Well, I think those people are using their sort of false spirituality as a drug. Mm-hmm. I think that they're getting an endorphin release, like a ping, like gamblers. I don't think it's any higher than that, frankly.
Yeah.
And that's pretty base.
And that is as base as it gets.
Right.
The brain will release endorphins, for a pleasure response. And what I see in these evangelical activities that go on is simply people whipping up kinetic energy and getting endorphin pings, from acting on their false religions. I mean, that's
right.
What I see, but.
Yes.
Anyway, so Wes, I'm sure you have some. I've been dominating. Say, Halo. I'm sorry. I've been just. It's so wonderful just to chat with you. I've been dominating the whole situation here. So I'm gonna turn things over to Wes for a moment.
And that's perfectly okay because I think I talk to each of you frequently. Right?
Yes.
Frequently and alone. So being a three-way conversation is pretty unique, but. Because I think Sahelu is edging towards further realization, I'm wondering why, and I'll ask you this, why do you think it's important, Sahelu, to pursue those things that are vague and in some cases appear to be like dreams, but they all center around an encounter with something other, and that could be an other type of being or an other type of existence or an other kind of a species. I think that we all get handed this opportunity once or twice in our life, but it goes by in a fleeting moment. But you've had more than one or two of these moments, and now you're thinking, gee, I gotta pursue this. Why do you think you have to pursue this?
Well, firstly, I will say why I need to pursue this is specifically one main thing that comes into my mind is growth, personal growth. Personal self-knowledge and personal understanding. If I am 5 or 6 years old in my room and I know there was a presence there was something there and it was scared me to death as a child, you know, and here I am, I'm coming full circle and I'm realizing there was something there because I've had, like you said, more than one of these experiences. So I know that there's something more that is important to my life. It's something that I must pursue. It's come to a point where I can no longer ignore these little occurrences. It's like something is tapping me on the shoulder and saying, hey, you might want to look in this direction. You might want to take a look here. And I think that engaging in a hypnosis session, you know, with Leslie, that going back to that day or that night rather, you know, in my room and really trying to tap into my memory of what really happened that night.
Mm-hmm.
Because that night was the very first time that I recall anything of a magical or extraterrestrial encounter that began to occur from that point on in up until today.
Mm.
And I want to know why. I want to know why, and I want to know the purpose. And this is the reason why I feel I must pursue that, is not only from what I originally stated, but that I need to pursue this because I want to know who and what and why was there, and what the purpose of this encounter was, and whatever this purpose that comes to my memories and to my understandings, that I can further move forward in my purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand what that means for this life and into the next life. And I want to be able to accomplish this. So does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah, I think Les is going to jump in on this because of her experience and because of her expertise.
And I can't help myself.
Right.
It's okay.
But, yeah, that addresses a central issue, I think.
Yes, and I think, Sahelu, that what we often find when you have, say, partially recalled memories, particularly childhood ones, I think that some of these memories are time dated in a sense. In other words, we reach a certain point in our maturity, in our quest, in our evolution, in our creative evolution, where we may be ready to hear and process the information
of
those early events. And also when we get in there with hypnosis, we usually find two things. The first thing being that, you know, childhood memories are not accurate. Even, you know, partially recalled childhood memories, and any fear or fear response probably had more to do with your child mind than it does with the reality of the encounter. So oftentimes, by looking at these childhood experiences, and I'm going to use the plural because it would be highly unusual, Sahelu, if we only found one. That would make you a tiny, tiny minority. Generally, there have been many more than one single experience, but those memories have been suppressed until you are ready to process them. And the beautiful thing about hypnotherapeutic regression, if it's done correctly, is the idea is to retain the information, retain the knowledge, retain the transcendent nature of the experience, but to release either fear or the negativity that may be attached to the event through misunderstanding, or the fear responses that are simply the result of being in a physical child's body when the experiences occurred.
Yeah. Wow, that's really amazing. Wow, I just have no words at the present moment.
Okay.
I'm just thinking that's absolutely fantastically wonderful. I mean, it just really puts into a better understanding and clarity of what I would be walking into, and that's fantastically great.
Well, it's all about all of these regression techniques. The way that we do them now in hypnosis is very different from even 20 years ago. And let's just say that I'm doing some type of a regression, and someone has partially remembered, you know, traumatic childhood memories from this life. And let's just take the metaphysical quotient, you know, right out of there. It used to be thought that in order to release fear and trauma of a given experience, that the person really had to re-experience it. And this was, of course, you know, daunting to anybody who wanted to go through a regression. Like, why would they want more pain? Why would they want to be, you know, reopened up? I mean, but what was discovered, you know, through, you know, some of the great contemporary hypnotherapists such as Milton Erickson, and I'm an Ericksonian hypnotherapist, we now know that you do not have to re-experience the trauma to understand it and process it. In fact, what I do is as soon as someone is showing distress around the experience, I turn them into an observer, where they're either floating above their body or they're in the safe position in the room, and I essentially cut off the fear responses. So intellectually observing the experience and understanding on a soul level that it was a version of you from another time, people can not only process the experience, but they can process it without re-traumatization, which to me is everything. And when they do that, then all that negativity of the experience falls away. It washes away like a rain shower. It just washes away. And what is left is the value and the lesson and how the experience can be transmuted to affect you practically in the here and now. So even though I deal in metaphysical areas, there's a very practical side to all of this. We're here in these dense physical forms moving about to gain experience. This is the whole thrust of this whole setup, this whole multi-dimensional setup that we have. This is the way to experience and learn. So when we really keep that in mind, we can face anything from the past and know that we can do so without re-injuring ourselves, while protecting that inner child. So in any regression process, if you are working with a well-trained Ericksonian-based hypnotherapist, there should never be a reason to be fearful of those experiences.
Wow, that's really awesome. I really like that idea.
Indeed, it's the key to everything.
Right.
Because you know, things like fear is the great blockade. I mean, it completely shuts down progress, happiness. Living in a state of fear, I don't think that there's anything more deleterious to the soul and the heart and the body than living in a state of fear.
Yes, I agree with that completely.
And just to touch on something, Sahelu, that Leslie was saying, when I first found Leslie, let's put it that way, because it was kind of an interesting journey to find her. When I first found Leslie, it was for one purpose, that I had to examine in more detail an experience that happened to me in the 1980s. And it dogged me all my life and still does to some extent, but I had to find out about that. And so once we got through the assessment process and some conversations and I did my first session, the very first thing that came up was a set of experiences from when I was a child. And so I say this only to say that it would be almost impossible for me to have had one adult experience. Mm-hmm. It had to have gone back to my childhood and actually, as I found out, beyond. Mm-hmm. It went to the interlife when I was planning to come back here. And so what you're saying, you know, this tip of the iceberg stuff, you must be feeling a certain kind of, let's call it pressure, to get this done.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, that tells me that the timing is right for you to explore whatever you need to explore, that you're in the right place in your life now to address whatever it is that we find. And I promise that we will make a plan to do that very, very soon.
Okay.
All right.
Wonderful.
So, Sahelu, why don't you talk about maybe not that experience, if that's okay, but you've had more than one. Do you want to recount, maybe spend a couple or 3 minutes, unless Leslie has another idea?
No, I just wanted to, I just have one more thing that I wanted to ask her, but we'll do that after. So yes, Sahelu, any other experiences that you'd like to shine some light on?
Sure. I will say, an experience that I had when I was about, 25 years old. And I have this tendency to do this quite often, is go to bed, I begin to have a dream, but everything in that dream is exactly, like, the bedroom is exactly the same way as it really is in real, is, you know, how I am living it. So it's like this alternate reality. The only difference is, at this one point in time, I recall laying on my bed, and I'm opening my eyes, and I look over, and here again, and here's an interesting connection, probably back to the age 5-6, but here I am laying on my bed, and I'm looking across my room over to the closet, and right next to my bed, standing and peering over me, is a, looked very, very Egyptian, like a dog, like Anubis sort of, sitting on haunches, very tall. Its head almost reached three quarters of the way to the ceiling in my room, and at the time I think I had a 9-foot ceiling. And it had sort of, I want to say, it almost looked a little bit Atlantean. It had some very distinct, squared off, but web-like ears, and it had a very, very pointy snout, and the eyes were ever so probing. I mean, it was literally like, it would probe and then it would, you know, stop, and then it would probe and it would stop. And I just recall looking at this creature, and I remember just freaking out, and I it took a little bit because, you know, it was hard for me to move, but I woke up out of this thing, and I sat up in my bed, and it dawned on me that this really just happened because the room I was in was actually the real room that I lived in, my bedroom. And the only difference was I had this interaction with this creature. And I want to say it was definitely Egyptian. I mean, it definitely had this, it sat on haunches. It was black. It could see every little tiny, tiny shape of its muscle. And it just had this intense presence. The presence was so strong. It was, and the strength of it was like iron. It was very, very powerfully strong. And I just remember being probed by this thing, and I freaked out and woke up and went, what the hell was that? You know.
Well, I think there are so many things that are intriguing about that, but one thing I will say, remember that beings can represent themselves to us kind of any way that they choose. Particularly if we're in an altered state, a state of lucid dreaming or a state of light consciousness, or
right.
And maybe what strikes me about this experience is the significance of the fact that you were presented with a being that you have no doubt was of Egyptian origin. So
yeah.
It's almost as if you were given an image that you could not waffle about, like, well, maybe it's Assyrian, maybe it's Chinese, maybe it's, what you were presented with, the being, my feeling, my spidey sense tells me that the being probably looked much more like you and I in reality, but the image of the strength of the ancient nature of the Egyptians, and previous to that, the Anunnaki, all of that was contained in that very powerful, powerful experience, where you were also made aware of your own telepathic abilities. Because if you were sensing that you were being probed, but maybe the being was just trying to say, look, here's this part of you that I can access, and you can access me this way too. You can access any way you wish this way. So I guess that's kind of what I mean by when we examine these things with the use of hypnosis, sometimes the intent, it becomes more clear. But beings will appear
right
in a wide variety of ways to accomplish whatever they wish to accomplish. And sometimes, you know, and this has been true certainly of Wes and many other individuals that I've worked with, sometimes in a regression about some kind of an encounter experience, the clearly extraterrestrial or ultra-terrestrial beings will disguise themselves as something as like a clown, you know, which they mean that image to be benign, to the child, because from whatever information they've gathered, they think that it's going to be a more comforting image than how they maybe actually look. But this isn't always
sure.
the case, because clowns can be pretty darn creepy, I'll tell you. But
yes.
Well, I'd be very anxious to get in there. I know we only have a few minutes left, believe it or not, but I did want to ask you, Sahelu, a very technical question about Egyptian dance and Egyptology. At the Alien Cosmic Expo this past summer, we had an individual who, his name is Jason Quitt, very intelligent, very well-spoken individual, and his course of study, and he even teaches this, is all about what he calls the Egyptian postures of power. Now, I saw his complete presentation. We had him on the show, and I'm still unclear about what he actually meant by that. I think what he was saying is that the images that we see of Egyptians going about their daily tasking, or even in their statuary, that their poses and their postures are not random, but represent a series of postures, maybe not unlike martial arts, if you will, where each posture has some type of a specific purpose. Now, I personally don't, I see the Egyptians as, I don't really, I'm having a very hard time with this concept. I have a much easier time understanding if there would be Egyptian dance that would be fluid, that would involve, trance-like instruments that would alter the consciousness, that would incorporate these different positions. So I guess what I'm saying is, are there positions, just like in ballet, are there positions in Egyptian dance that have spiritual or metaphysical function or purpose?
Hurry. Yeah, I heard you talking about the postures, the Egyptian postures of power that this Jason Quitt was talking about.
Yes.
And that yes, I do understand, or I think I understand where he might have been going with this, but I can give you sort of my insight on my experiences and workings with this type of thing.
Please do.
I do know that the Egyptians and the classical dance of India, even Bharatanatyam specifically, the one I've been studying for a while, there's a lot of similarities. And I will say in Bharatanatyam there is a word, and it the word or a term is called a bhangima. And a bhangima is a position or a posture in which the dancer is in stance or a position.
Yes.
And it gets very, very technical of why your feet will be crossed and why you would be like in a plié or a squat position, depending upon what your arms are doing, where your hands are, your eyes, your expression on your face. It gets very, very intricate. Now, the ancient Egyptians, they had something of the same thing, and it's very interesting how the two connect, because they both have, and I'll just label it what it is for easier understanding purposes, is mudras, hand gestures, facial gestures, body gestures, from the torso to the legs to the feet, predominantly the hands and postures of how you're sitting, standing, kneeling, squatting, crouching. All of these things mean something when you put everything together into a kinetic motion that you are actually telling a story, or you are working a magical operation, or you are doing these things. And the ancient Egyptians have this thing similar to the bhangima, which is called charonymy. Charonymy are the gestures and body positions, or bhangimas, if you will, that are very similar, yet they are distinctly different in how the gestures and body positions are used. The ancient Egyptians in the Sheronomy also used clapping techniques, as far as, you know, the rhythmical patterns that come into play, and these clapping techniques act as like the metronome to the timetable of how quickly